All right, here we go. This is episode 28, I hope, of Fresh Out of Tokens. I'm Tanya, also known as Cypher Tier, and to my virtual right is David. Say hi, David.
Hello. How's it going?
I'm very, very happy to say that we have Jeremy Yoder of the Geek Cross Show with us. Say hi.
Hi. It's good. It's great to be here.
Yes, this has been a long time coming. I'm so happy we get a chance to have you on the other side of the mic today.
I know. I mean, so you asked me to be on your show, and I was like, well, when would be a good time for me to come on? And you were like, November. So it's been about 2 or 3 months since we talked about it.
Yeah, but hey, all good things come to those who wait. So this was a long time in coming, and it'll be a very lively, interesting conversation based on the things we talked about before we hit the record button. So let me get our intro business out of the way, and we can jump right into discussion. For those of you listening, we are part of the Geek.fm network, along with Geeks and Sneaks, Chromatic Life, and More Than Bits podcasts. We have teas, coffee mugs, and other items in the I Need to Rest Games Spreadshirt shop, and we split the profits 50-50 with our friend Chachi Bobanks, and there is a blog to complement our show. Follow us at outoftokenscast.wordpress.com, or send us an email at freshoutoftokens@gmail.com. So that's question, compliments, hate mail, but we won't respond to your hate mail because, hey, we have other things to do. Or, you know, add us on Twitter at @OutOfTokensCast. So with the usual, hey, it's us business out of the way, let's get right into talking to our guest. So for those folks listening, they may not know who you are and what it is that you do. So can you tell us all about Jeremy?
All about Jeremy. Oh, where to start? Well, now I know how I always ask the same kind of question when I'm hosting the show and people are like, and now that I'm on the other side of the mic, I kind of understand why they're doing that. Well, first and foremost, I guess career-wise, I am a Mennonite pastor, and I pastor a small congregation in southeastern rural Colorado. I am also, as you said, the host of the podcast Geek Cross, which actually has been on kind of unintended hiatus for the last, I guess, about month and a half, but I'm hoping to get the show back on the road. Basically, the podcast has dealt with topics of religion and faith and geekdom, sometimes other issues as well, but basically, you know, I'm interested in the intersection, the where these things kind of come together between culture and faith and politics, and so we have conversations about these kinds of topics.
And the second question for every guest of this show is, so what got you into gaming? Or, if that's too specific, just nerdy stuff in general will do.
Well, as Tanya said, I'm not really much of a gamer. That actually would be my 7-year-old daughter, who I think is in the process of becoming Queen of the Geeks someday. But, you know, I'm not much a gamer. I enjoy games. I enjoy the world of games. I like to pay attention to what's going on, but I'm not a person that spends enormous amounts of time sitting in front of a console or a computer playing games. The heyday, actually, of my game playing would have been back in the late 80s and early 90s on a DOS PC, a 386, and playing games like Civilization and SimCity and Railroad Tycoon. Those were kind of the games that I loved growing up. The LucasArts adventure games, that was another thing I loved growing up. So I do have an interest in sort of retro gaming. I actually having sitting next to my desk here an old DOS computer that I found that I am actually hoping to get running up and get some old games and put them on again. But that's kind of my own interest. Other than that, I do play some casual games.
Okay.
But as an adult with kids and a wife in school, you know, I don't really have the time to sit down and spend 60 hours on a game.
Yeah. Yeah, 60 hours on a game is something I kind of had to take vacation time to do.
I mean, I do have a kind of dysfunctional relationship with Zelda, with Twilight Princess. I play that about every few months and until I get angry. And then I stop, and then I pick it up again a few months later and get angry with it again. So okay. I do have that going on.
Okay. And you touched on, you know, the intersection of religion and geekery and nerdery. But, you know, I even though I've been a guest on the show, it's always interested me of, you know, how do you reconcile those things? Because a lot of people think like, oh, if I'm into certain things, like, or they just think that faith and nerdery cannot coexist.
I mean, there is that perception, and there are certainly people that feel that way. Mm-hmm. You know, growing up, I remember there was this kind of tension about it. I you know, growing up in sort of the late 80s, you know, I remember there were things like Ghostbusters that were seen as kind of not kosher for Christians to watch because it dealt with spiritual ghosts and things like that. Mm-hmm. I also certainly remember the Dungeons and Dragons scare, you know, and you know, the fear that there are kids going around, you know, murdering people because of that. So there has always been this tension. I also come from a very conservative religious background, which in general has a very negative view of pop culture and views it with suspicion. It's a worldly thing. It's a thing that is not, should, you know, distracts you from what is supposed to be good and holy and what you're supposed to pay attention to. You, entertainment in general is bad, worldly entertainment. I dealt with that in some of my own family. My father was very suspicious of entertainment. He thought it was sort of frivolous. And I remember having to negotiate with him in order to go see Jurassic Park when it came out, which was, I think, the greatest pop culture experience of my childhood. And, you know, having negotiated, being willing to watch some documentaries so that I had balance from, you know, the computer graphic dinosaurs. So there has always been, there are these tensions. At the same time, as an adult now, I do know a number of people who are, particularly men, who are very into theology and into geek stuff and do kind of make a connection between the two. One of the interviews that I did before the show went on hiatus was with Robert Martin. That was probably the geekiest conversation I had, where we talked about Tolkien and faith and how those things connected. And so there are people out there who have this connection between sort of deep interest in theology and also into geek stuff.
Cool. Well, for those of you listening, and this is a little bit behind the scenes for you, normally we have all our questions kind of mapped out. And one thing we're trying to do this time is, you know, just have talking points, jumping off points of interest for us and our guest. So if you like this format or if you think it works better than just kind of a script, quote unquote, please let us know if you've listened to the episode. And so I'm going to pull the curtain back in front of your eyes and let David kind of kick us off with our first talking point.
The thing about Ghostbusters is that the spiritual stuff in there, the ghost stuff, I mean, it's not real. And the question is, I think the problem back in the 80s was that for some people, even if it's not real, because it is about the supernatural, pose some sort of danger, some sort of, it would suck you up into it and get you, next thing you know, you're doing Ouija boards and satanic rituals or something. Like, dealing with spiritual issues can be very sort of tricky because it kind of goes into the turf of religion, and yet it's not a Christian outlook. There's nothing in Ghostbusters that really has a Christian perspective. And so I think for some people they were very uncomfortable about that. Whether or not it's more secular today, I don't know. I think in general, our culture and our society is more secular and much more suspicious of religion, and I think geek stuff and pop culture reflects some of that.
Maybe it could be that I grew up loving science fiction, so it's easy for me to see established science fiction writers would sort of respond to things like Ghostbusters and so on as, it's not even plausible.
Well, yeah, right.
And I'm like,
Well, it's not about being plausible. It's about story and about fun. And you do kind of have to check out your brain, you know, at the door.
Well, one thing I was thinking about, and we'll bring it up when we discuss the article a little bit later, is that intersection of religion and gaming.
Mm-hmm.
Because the article that we've got kind of on deck for once, because we haven't had an article to discuss in a while, is about Bioshock Infinite. And while the article is more about PTSD in Bioshock Infinite, there's always been an issue / concern for me with the religious overtones that start in the game and kind of how you have to almost fake being faithful to progress in the game, you know, like when you're baptized. Have you played Bioshock Infinite?
I have not, but I'm aware of some of the issues that are in there.
Well, you know, you kind of come around, and when you try to exit into the city, and it's like the steampunky kind of place, and David, feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, because it's been a long time since I've touched this game.
I'm not an expert either.
It's okay. Well, it's like, if you know something that I misquote, feel free to jump in. But you come out of the sewer, and there's this preacher, and you have the option to be baptized. And I'm like, that's interesting, but, you know, what if that conflicts with a person's personal faith? And I know these are some people that just go, oh, it's a game, it's not that serious. But if you're deeply a person of faith, and that's not your faith, could that, like, break immersion? Would that be something that would be like, okay, I can't play this game anymore?
Well, I think for myself, the fact that you would suddenly, it sounds like, have a rather random sort of encounter with a religious figure and baptism and all that would probably break immersion for me. I have a hard time with the depiction of a lot of religious people in games or in media, because often it's really, I think, based on stereotypes, right? There are two kind of general stereotypes of Christians. One is either Catholic or, I guess, evangelical Pentecostal. And they're usually pretty negative depictions of religious people. Usually hypocrites or something like that, or kind of speak in this kind of weird, stereotypical religiese. And so often I haven't really encountered in gaming or in a lot of media sort of religious people that ring true to me. It seems to me more about stereotypes, about certain tropes that are kind of recognized in culture.
Okay. So like I said, I haven't played the game in a while, but that just, like, it threw me for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure, like, what other religion intersections of gaming material you look at, but there's a young man called Nelson who does video games in the Bible. And he tries to look at these things from a biblical perspective. And he actually, there's a game he found that he's, like, really, really into and, like, streaming a lot. But it was interesting because, like, he's also a very young man. And to see him struggle a lot of times with, this is my faith, I'm firm in my faith, but this hobby I enjoy doesn't depict the entirety of who I am. How do I reconcile that? Because, like, you're a pastor as well. So, you know, how do you reconcile not just gaming, but all of your kind of geeky, nerdy interests, and, you know, they don't do a good job of showing this aspect of you. How do you reconcile that with still continuing to enjoy that media?
Well, often for me, the focus isn't actually on depictions of religious people. I mean, there aren't that many depictions, and like I said, often they're stereotypical. More has to do with themes. The themes that you encounter within games or within films or books, and how that might have some theological connections. So Robert Martin, who I cited a little bit ago, has done a number of blog posts about Doctor Who and how, you know, some of the episodes have with them Christian themes of redemption and reconciliation and nonviolence and things like that. So those are the kinds of things that we can connect with. So for example, a number of months ago, of course, was the Mad Max movie Fury Road came out. I went and saw that in the theater, and that is sort of deep resonance with the film. The film is actually incredibly theological, the kinds of themes that are in it, the desert, the wasteland, the destruction of life in the wilderness, and yet the hope of redemption and reconciliation. This vision, this imagery of streams in the desert resonates very deeply with the book of Isaiah. So those are the kinds of things that when you're kind of looking at theology and faith and geek stuff, you're looking at themes, and there are certain themes that have resonance and connection. You're not so much looking at, particularly at the depiction of religious people.
Okay, that's really good, because, you know, I keep thinking of, you're not of things that don't depict those of faith versus themes, because the Maddox is not something that actually jumped out at me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I could see that. I could also see, like, you were mentioning Mad Max. One of the, like, major themes I've noticed over the series is that any time the character of Max himself makes a decision, people get hurt. That's why he sort of, in that most recent movie, seems to wander around looking for instruction or trying to avoid people entirely.
Right, right.
Huh. I will have to look for that when I watch the movie again, because I hadn't thought of that point either, David.
Yeah, well, the only decisions he makes in the most recent movie are the spoiler blood transfusion thing, and when he murders the bullet farmer very effectively and very quickly.
True. I think it's safe to talk about spoilers. The movie's not on DVD, so...
One would hope.
Well,
you'd hope.
But, I mean, in that movie, Mad Max is almost not the main character. I mean, the main character actually is the Charlize Theron character. You know, she's the one who is the engine, and, you know, the driving the engine, so to speak. And she's the one who makes the decisions. The film is almost not really about him. It's about her and her decision. You know, they flee from the Citadel. They go look for the Greenlands, and they discover that it's no longer exists. And they make the decision to go back to the Citadel, where they deliver and they free the people there. And the water that is being hoarded is released. And the wealth of the Citadel is shared with the entire community. That you can make some religious arguments about. That connects with certain passages and certain themes within the Bible and theology.
Okay. Huh. See, now I'm going to be looking for all this whenever I watch the movie again.
There's actually a really good review that was on the website for a magazine called Christianity Today of Mad Max, and it brought out some of these themes, so you may want to take a look for that.
Okay. Maybe once we're done, you can shoot me a link, because that sounds really fascinating, because this is clearly stuff I would not have thought about.
Well, that's the thing kind of about what I do. I mean, you know, I'm a pastor. I deal with the Bible. I read theology. I read scripture, try to interpret scripture. And so because that's what I do, you know, in my career, my work, I kind of see the world through that filter. And so I make those kinds of connections that somebody else might not make who isn't doing that or doesn't have that background.
True. So very true.
So I'm bringing my other reality into my geek stuff, you know. That was the great thing about the podcast, is I could connect those two things for myself, you know.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I finally finished listening to the episode with Sharif Jackson, and I was just like, I have all these thoughts. I have to flail at both of you.
maybe all three of us can sit down sometime.
Yes, that would be awesome. And then we have to get David in, because, you know, David doesn't do enough guesting. I'm just being horribly enabling. He'd be like, you need to do more guesting, and not just me.
Yeah, that's true. I probably should.
Yes, so you should totally be on Geek Cross.
Yeah, I'd totally love to have you on.
I think based on the conversation we were having about Shadowrun prior to starting recording, you probably could talk for hours about that.
Well, I've actually played Shadowrun. I actually know what he's talking about.
Well, speaking of Shadowrun and geeky things, this is putting me in mind of you know, computers and... Mm-hmm. And dystopia, and one thing you want to talk about was this computer rehab project that you've got going on.
Well, it's not quite off the ground yet, but basically the idea is, the vision is, so Zeph McLaren, who produces Geek Cross, he also works for the local recycling center. He does their electronic recycling. And we kind of ended up having a conversation about, what if we took some of these old computers that are on their way to being recycled, on their way to being, you know, torn apart, and rehab them, rebuild them, try to boost them up a bit, and then sell them for cheap, super cheap, to low-income families in the community? What would that help with in terms of empowering people? Because one of the things that is a kind of a reality, you know, we talk about the digital divide and the difference between rich and poor when it comes to access of technology. Well, in a low-income rural community like the one that I live in, that's actually a pretty serious problem. One of the things I've noticed is that our library, for example, is the primary access for technology for a lot of people. And the computer lab at the library is always full. A lot of people don't really have computers. At best, they might have a smartphone. So would be taking these old computers and refurbishing them and giving access to them, would that empower people and to improve their lives? So that's one of the questions that we've been asking, because I've become more and more concerned about the connection between ecology and economics and spirituality. Where do all these things connect? And I think how we spend our money and what we do with our stuff, with our junk, actually has spiritual implications. And so e-waste is a pretty significant issue. I mean, there are dumps in the third world, in the developing South, the global South, you know, that are filled with our computer junk. If we can prevent a few things from going out there by refurbishing them, that's perhaps a better use of a stewarding of our limited resources. So that's one of the things I'm working on. We've been trying to get one computer built. We've had some problems because we're dealing with stuff that was actually on a landfill at one point before it got pulled to be recycled. So we were dealing with hard drives that are failing, motherboards that are failing. Fortunately, we have enough computers coming in that eventually, you know, we'll score. Eventually we'll get one that works, you know. But so we've had some problems with it. So it's not quite off the ground yet, but it's something that we're working on. It doesn't solve everything. The question of internet access is still something that is a problem. It's still unaffordable for a lot of people. But I figured, you know, you can only do so much. You can only do what you can't do. And it's better to do something than to do nothing.
Yeah, because, I mean, at worst, even if someone can't get online, they can do work at home, bring a flash drive to the library, and at least print out something, email something.
Exactly. You could still do word processing, that kind of stuff, at the very least. Exactly. And you know, there, a number of years ago, there was a conversation about community internet, you know, in the town that I live in, and it went nowhere. And maybe if people start having access to computers, maybe we can put some political pressure on the city to look at that again. I don't know, but it's an attempt to do something, you know?
Yeah. No, this discussion was making me think about, you know, access and STEM and parenting and gaming, because, you know, I work at a STEM school, and a lot of the times when we talk about STEM and access and things like that, people don't think about those that may not have access to these things until they get to college, maybe high school, depending on where they go to high school. And, you know, as someone who wants to do the best for their child, if you don't have access, if you never had those resources, how do you then kind of help your children make that next step that maybe you were never able to take?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, I mean, one of the things I've noticed living in, you know, I'm originally a city person, grew up in cities, and this is the smallest community that I've ever lived in. And one thing is I've noticed is that there are some parallels between, say, white flight, the effects of white flight in the 50s and 60s in urban centers, and rural depopulation that's going on now. And there are some similarities. When you take resources out of a community, both financial resources and people resources, it has a sort of a devastating impact on what happens to the community. Communities then tend to go down, and crime goes up, and you have multi-generational systemic poverty, and those kinds of things. And those are the kind of things I'm seeing in a small town that I experienced when I was living in suburban Chicago or in Baltimore. And how do you deal with that? How do you help people break through with that? The model primarily has been from churches, has been charity. And charity is important, but that only goes so far, right? You help somebody out with their power bill, what are they going to do next month? And so for me, part of the question is, how do we empower people to have some hope in their lives, have some economic hope? And how can you provide them some tools? And so the hope is by providing access to technology that gives people some tools to change their circumstances.
Okay. Because, David, you've lived in a lot of different places.
Yeah, I move a lot.
Well, and you were in the service, too. So, you know, like, have you... What... Because you've lived in New Orleans, and, you know, if I'm wrong, correct me, because I don't know all the places that you've been.
I lived in New Orleans for about a year, yeah.
Okay. You know, is that something that you would see, like, access or lack of access, or, like, even being in the military, did you ever see people where it was kind of clear they didn't have access to some of these resources and training and, you know, concepts until they got in the service?
Well, it would be hard to tell in the military, because once you've met everyone, they're in the military.
Yeah.
So they have access to all of the same things you do.
Well, I was thinking in terms of, like, you know, when you talk to people, or like if you have classes or, you know, or training, it's like, you know, stuff that maybe one person didn't know because of their background prior to joining the military.
I'm not sure. I worked on electronics.
Okay.
It was a pretty nerdy shop.
really?
I will say, though, that living in New Orleans, we had some of the fastest internet I've ever had. And I think that might just be because my neighbors weren't on the internet.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah.
I lived like on the border of like the 6th Ward in Treme. So it wasn't the best neighborhood.
Okay. Well, it's something that I think about, and actually had a conversation with a colleague today where there's people have great ideas, but then they don't think about like the smaller moving parts of, oh, we should do more to help people have access, but we need to, you know, convince the upper administration. But if you have people who never had to deal with not having the access, how do you kind of bridge that gap?
Yeah.
And then go out to the community and not sound like you're basically going, here, poor person, I'm going to help you. Take it and be grateful.
I do feel like New Orleans would be unique compared to other cities or maybe some rural places, in that part of the reason why maybe they didn't have as many like people on the like, I don't know of anyone else who was in my building that was on the internet except on their phones.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe part of the reason behind that is that you can make a living without it there.
Okay.
Not a great one, but...
yeah. Jeremy, do you have any other thoughts about that?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why we made the decision that we're not just simply giving away computers, that we would charge them some sort of nominal fee, like $30 for a computer, monitor, and keyboard mouse. Mm-hmm. Partly because there's costs associated with it. We would have to source some things, like keyboard and mice. But also, I think having people pay for it gives some sense of ownership rather than just giving it away. And I think having people pay for it or contribute in some way also gives people some dignity. That's one of the things that I experience a lot when I'm dealing with people who are marginal, is that often there's not a lot of dignity, right? It's pretty embarrassing to have to, you know, go to a food bank, or it's pretty embarrassing to have to call up a church and ask for some help. You know, there are power issues there involved too. You know, we have to. I mean, my congregation has got a line item in our budget where we help people, but then we get to choose who to help and when. On the one hand, we have to because we have limited funds and we have to be good stewards of that. But at the same time, there's some power issues there. There's an inequality there. So my hope is that when you actually have people who put in something into it, some money or something else, it helps give some dignity to that person. It helps to equalize relationship a bit. That's why, for example, Habitat for Humanity requires the families or the people who are receiving a house to put in what they call sweat equity. Right, you have to help out, and that gives you some dignity. It's not just a handout. You're just not a target for charity, and I think that's kind of often what's missing in some of these kinds of conversations. We assume that we who have something, right, we who have the technology, mm-hmm. we who have the resources, are just simply to give them to those who don't have anything without really building relationships or understanding what they're experiencing. And that's when we had that kind of, here, poor person, here's a device kind of thing that you were talking about.
The reason why I said that might be unique to New Orleans is, like, while I was in New Orleans, the person I was dating at the time made most of her income from the fact that she knew how to juggle. Which isn't true in, like, Chicago or New York.
True.
That's not an opportunity that exists most places.
No, it's certainly not in southeastern Colorado.
Yeah. Nah. So when you have, like, economically depressed portions of a population, minorities, felons, you know, anyone that gets caught in that sort of environment... I don't know how they survive in any other city. I really don't. Yeah.
Well, people learn how to survive, and they often learn how to survive by gaming the system. They know where to go for help, right? They know how to, they hustle. I mean, they have to hustle.
New Orleans is also like full of anarchists who have their co-ops, and you can get like free bikes and stuff if you really know who to talk to.
Interesting. Yeah. I've never been in New Orleans. I need to go because I'm pretty sure I have family down there somewhere.
Yeah. As it turns out, anarchists are very charitable people.
Interesting. Well,
good to know. I did not know that.
So we've kind of meandered around and talked about, you know, like... No, it's good. I like meandering because that's the best conversation.
Here's what I would say. this is what I imagine they would say, like, on like Fox News, is that they would point out that if you give someone like a, or if you sell someone a very cheap computer, then they can play games on it. But we have a talking point about STEM and gaming, so maybe you could tell us how that's okay. That's probably good. Let's be honest.
I think, I mean, it's a bit of a controversy in my house. Like I said, my 7-year-old daughter, my oldest daughter, I think she's going to be a gamer, loves games, loves to do stuff. And for us, what's been good about, my wife, however, is kind of suspicious of games. And so we have a bit of a conflict. We have a Wii, and, you know, my daughter loves to play on the Wii. And one of the things that we have used the Wii for is to teach her patience and teach her how to practice, because my daughter is very impatient and wants to do things right the first time. So gaming has a way, like Mario Kart or the Mario, is it the World, Mario World 3D, has given her a chance to fail a lot in a safe place, right? To make a mistake and then go back and do it again and again and again. And I think that has been really good for her, to get her to sort of practice and learn how to work at something and get better at something. So I think that's been a really positive thing about gaming and my daughter. What has also been interesting is because of her interest in technology, because of gaming, she wants to be an inventor and an astronaut when she grows up. So I decided is to try to promote this. And so she and I have been doing projects together. And a few weeks ago, we put our first circuit together. We get these things called Tinker Crates. And each month, we get a little red box. And in it, it's got like an experiment or some sort of technology thing that explains a certain principle. And I think it was electricity was the theme. And what she had was a little kit that was a hand crank LED flashlight that you had to put together, and you had to put the circuit together. And I never put a circuit together, she had never done it, and we figured it out. We had to actually go back and troubleshoot it because it didn't work. She had put it together and it didn't work, and so we had to go back and kind of put it together and do step by step and get it to work. And so that's really cool. So I think, you know, kids are interested in these kinds of things, but they don't often have exposure to them. And I think games can give exposure to things that kids otherwise might not have in their real life. So for me, you know, having somebody play games on a computer that I help build, that's not an issue for me.
Well, and you know, and games give us a lot of skills, despite what some people may think, because I'm sure a lot of the problem solving skills and this is weird to say, but even diplomacy for making decisions in games. Not that I have a lot of diplomacy.
You don't strike me as a diplomatic person, Tanya.
I'm not. There's no getting around it. There are many times when I failed that diplomacy check critically. But I think what were you going to say, David? I heard a
Yeah. Oh, I'm one of those people where I'm one of those people who complained about in Fallout 3 you couldn't talk your way out of enough things.
Uh-huh. Okay.
There were too many situations where you're like, yeah, we could talk our way out of this if you give us the option.
Huh. Interesting. Because
like that camp.
Okay. I mean, you can probably talk your way out of a lot of things. I cannot. I'm the warrior class most of the time, and it gets me in trouble. But I think people have this odd idea about games also as a luxury versus a tool that can teach you.
Well, you know, speaking of which, you know, I think one of the things that I saw in the past year that was incredibly powerful was Kiva Bay's cartoon about homelessness and gaming, right, and how the role that it played in helping her survive when she was out on the streets. I have a guy in my church who was extremely poor, loves games, cannot afford games, right? Can't afford a system. So what he ends up doing is watches a lot of Let's Play videos. And we have conversations about it. We talk about the Let's Play videos that he watches and his passion for these games that he will never, ever be able to afford. And I think, you know, it's something to have about the fact that there's some sort of entertainment, that there's some sort of escape, of helping to cope with life. I think that's a perfectly legitimate thing, you know, to feel normal. And if entertainment and games helps you feel normal when your life is out of control, who am I to judge that?
Well, you also have compassion.
Well, I try.
Well, it's just like when you see people arguing about, like, oh, you've got a smartphone, so you can't be that poor off. And
well, you see, yeah, I was a failed insurance salesman after college.
Really?
I tried to sell life insurance. For a brief time, I was not very good at it. But I went to a lot of people's homes, many who had not much money. And the one thing they had was a large television, right? Mm-hmm. And always the criticism is, why are you spending all this money on a TV? Well, it's to feel normal, right? It's to feel like you have access to some of the good things in life that everybody else does. I mean, everybody uses money in ways that aren't wise. Everybody wastes money on things that they probably shouldn't spend money on.
I'm not sure it's wasting.
Is that I'm not sure it's wasting either. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's not the right word. But you know, I mean, the people who don't have a lot of resources, there's a lot more cost to it than there is for those who are wealthy and can afford to indulge themselves. But maybe waste is the wrong word.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like from like a biological standpoint, leisure is massively important.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause if you take any animal and you put it under stress for prolonged periods of time, it will go badly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that.
I mean, cats spend like 8/10 of their time half asleep.
True.
Yeah. I mean, we need to have a balance of work, too. I mean, work is a good thing as well that we also undervalue in our culture. But the image of a, you know, all work and no play, which is kind of what our culture does, right? We have the least amount of vacation time in the developed world. You know, that's also dangerous. That's also
we're also the country that made the Jetsons, which just says a lot about the way we view technology. Because apparently, 50 years ago, they were like, oh yeah, and we'll have robots, and everyone will have so much free time, we'll have to invent fake jobs.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
And we got the robots, but like we have assembly lines without people now, but we don't have...
Yeah, exactly.
Huh. Yeah, because we overvalue work. And not just in what you do, but, you know, a lot of people's identities are wrapped up in their job. And I know people that, you know, have gotten sick from not taking vacation, or they go to work because they're sick. It's because the idea that if you don't work, you're not valuable.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's one of those things where it's like, it took me a very long time to realize that, you know, my identity is not wrapped up in my job. And if I work until I'm sick or go to work when I'm sick, I'm replaceable. It is not like the work will stop without me. So that's...
Oh, we're all replaceable. That's the thing that's so hard for us to understand. Every one of us can be replaced in our job.
Oh, yeah. You know, I have skills that will make it not simple to replace me, but I could be replaced. But we actually kind of already talked about religion and games quite a bit. We've actually got a bunch of questions for you in an article to discuss. So we can, you know, other than talking about what's next for you.
Sure. Well, let me talk a little bit why the show went on hiatus a little bit.
Okay.
And why what I'm hoping to do next. So October was a really bad month for me. I totaled my car at the end of September. I ran a stop sign and got hit, and my 3-year-old daughter was in the back seat. And she was okay, and I was okay, but I kind of spent this past month trying to get things back into order. And you know, I got a new car, and we're moving on, and that's behind us. And also, my wife is in nursing school, and so I am kind of the single dad and doing a lot of things at home. And on top of that, I'm teaching a class in logic at the local community college.
Oh, wow.
Which I know nothing about. I know nothing about logic. So I'm teaching myself and trying to teach these kids at the same time. So because of that, and because the show is a hobby, I don't have any sponsors. I don't have any obligations. I could take time away from the show, and it just kind of sort of stopped it. So the trick now is to get going again and to pick it up, and because I do miss it, I do miss doing it, and I miss the conversations that I've had. So I have some solo topics I want to do a few episodes on. I've been trying to do some research on that and want to write them out a little bit. So there's that. Let's see what else. My wife is finishing nursing school next year, and so a lot of our discussions, what's next for us as a family. And also, I'm actually now in the process of starting to produce a podcast for someone.
Oh, cool.
Called Bison Radio. And it's a project that I was invited on by a gentleman named John Byler, who is a survivor of traumatic brain injury. And it will be a podcast basically dealing with traumatic brain injury. And how do you deal with it? What was your experience? Those kinds of things. So that's something actually where we're in the process of getting off the ground, and I'll be producing that.
Awesome. Well, let us know when it gets off the ground so we can promote it, because that sounds really intriguing.
I'll definitely let you know. I mean, there's an entire community out there. Brain injury is one of the things that we don't really talk about a lot, but it happens all the time, and a lot of these people are struggling, and there's a real need for that. So my hope is that a podcast like that could help do some good.
Oh, that sounds really cool.
So I still have a full plate here.
Yeah, because working and school is something I never ever want to do again, even though I considered it this fall. But, you know, things worked out where school was not a possibility. Because a degree program and full-time job, not a good match, listeners, just so you know.
And kids. When you add kids into the situation, it gets even more complicated.
Ooh.
But sometimes you got to do what you got to do, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, as someone who has gone through a lot of school and needing a support network, definitely feel free to let me know if you need anything.
Okay, I might call and cry on your shoulder.
Sure. Hey, there have been nights where I cried.
Me too. You can call me too. I can hardly take care of my cats. I can't imagine.
Oh my God.
Well, I mean, my kids aren't dead yet, and they seem to be thriving, so something's going right.
Oh my God. Well, I would hope that they're thriving. So
they do get to watch a whole lot more TV than they probably should.
You win some, you lose some.
Right.
So we've actually got an article this week, and we got some really good questions for you from our friend Tim.
Sure.
So, you know, even though you've not played much of BioShock, I've played it, but it's been a long time, and David hasn't played it or not played much of it.
I don't know specifics about it.
But I just thought this was a really interesting article by Riley McLeod, who we got the chance to meet while we were at IndieCade, about post-traumatic stress syndrome and also trauma in BioShock Infinite. Because, you know, the article header, and it's in there a couple times, this image of the pastor reaching out to you and, you know, make the joke, if you will, uh-huh, press F to accept baptism. And it's uh-huh, just interesting because, you know, Riley made it a very personal piece as well, you know, talking about there's that loss of time and, you know, things that I swore happened a year ago or 5 years ago, but it really didn't. And I thought it was really interesting because there seems to be this constant shock that your character's going through. And this is a spoiler for the game. You know, someone gave it away for me, but the character you're playing is actually passing for white. And there's a lot of trauma that you see because you were at the Battle of Wounded Knee, and, you know, this, and war is its own special kind of trauma that people deal with and come back from. And it's just really, I just thought it was very interesting and very, very revealing about this theme that was in a game that I never thought about. I was so focused when I played it played the game about, oh, the terrible racism in it. Like, that was kind of like what I was looking at and trying to dissect it from, but I'd never thought of this angle.
Well, I think that says a lot about the game. I mean, these things, the best kind of art, whether it's a book or a film or a game, a video game, you know, functions on different levels. And we bring ourselves to that, and we see things based on our own experiences. So I think that says a lot about the story and the depth to it, if you were able to take something else from it.
True, and granted, I wasn't looking for that as I played the game, because a friend of mine, who actually became a friend because of gaming and talking about Mass Effect, was like, I'm really interested to see what you get out of this, because your perspective as a black woman who's older is going to be different than mine as like a cis white straight dude who has none of these other issues to consider. But, you know, you have someone who's passing, who has all this trauma in their background, who's done terrible things, the Battle of Wounded Knee, and yet they still have to go on and keep doing these other things. Because you kill a lot of people in Bioshock. It is not a peaceful game in any way, shape, or form. But I think it's odd that I didn't pick up that from the story either, because it seems like that should have been a theme so heavy, I guess, as trauma and dealing with this as a character. It never resonated, never jumped out at me.
So why does it bother you so much?
Mostly because when I play a game, I want the whole experience, but I also don't want to become that person that is so narrowly focused on this game isn't diverse, it's terrible, that I can't see other things and pull other things from the narrative.
I think, though, the very, like, best and most successful narratives are things you can never experience all of. I'm a fiction editor, so one of the ways to look at crafting a narrative is that you're trying to see how many chains of logic you can pull through this series of events. That's your job as a writer.
Okay.
We've all seen like authors who clearly have one in their own head that doesn't seem compatible with most of society.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I experience that almost every Sunday when I go up and I preach a sermon, and I have people come up and say to me, oh, the fact that you said this and this and this, that meant so much to me. And I'm like, I didn't say that, you know? Sometimes what we hear and what we experience is not always what's intended. And I think we have to give space for there to be multiple levels of meaning and multiple ways of understanding something, depending on what people are bringing to it. And, you know, I wouldn't feel so bad, Tanya, that you didn't see other aspects of it. But I think that you're more aware of it now. That's a good thing. And maybe when you play something else, you can think about some of these other things, too.
True.
But I wouldn't be so hard. I wouldn't be so hard.
No, I don't want to become that person who's like, rawr, it's not diverse, and yell at all the games either. So I don't want to go into my games with blinders on, basically.
I mean, games are becoming more diverse. Is that right?
Slowly, yes.
So do you think that as games become more diverse, you can look at games with cis white males in it and not scream at the games? Or, I mean...
You know, for me, it's... See, you tricked me. This is Pastor Jeremy coming out.
I'm sure we're allowed to exist, right? That's more or less what that question boiled down to.
Yes, you can exist, David. But I'm like, aha, I see what you're doing. Pastor Jeremy just crept out.
I pastored you, yes.
I see what you did there.
It's my job to ask questions.
It's just hilarious. I'm like, aha, I see you. Now you've made me think really hard. They're getting diverse, and it's I don't scream at every single game that it's not diverse, but I don't want that to be the very microscopic lens I view everything through and miss the larger pieces, where that's like the only thing I'm viewing it through.
Do you find yourself as an activist for games diversity? That is a temptation?
Very much so.
Do you, David? I mean, I don't know what your relationship is with gaming and diversity, but do you find yourself tempted by certain things or focus on certain things?
Sometimes it has to be a little more obvious for me to start questioning certain things, unless that's what I'm there to do, because, you know, I can do it on purpose. One thing I actually like about video games in general is it's sort of an exercise in editorial oversight, because they have to write a story without knowing exactly who their main character is. So you just end up with a dozen different possible things you can piece together. And one of them usually ends up being the most well put together. For example, in Dragon Age 2, if you are a mage, the story seems tailored to your sort of character.
That's true.
Also, yes. If you're a dude.
I mean, it is. It's and BioWare games do this a lot. It's like, if you don't take a set path, they almost punish you for these other decisions. And actually, since we have you on the show, this is something I've always thought about before we actually really segue into our questions, is there's an issue. I mean, the whole Mage Templar War thing in the Dragon Age series, it is a clash of freedom versus faith, freedom for the mages versus the upholding of the Chantry, which is the religious arm of the game world.
If you're a mage then you have a Carver,
yes,
right? Your brother, who becomes at some point in the game a Templar, which brings the conflict like into your
right, because
home.
You're
so it's a conflict between freedom and being part of a faith community. Is that what I understand?
Yes, because you know the narrative they gave you basically is if you're a mage, you can't really be part of this. It's like, you know, you have no liberties. You're literally locked away in a tower once you come into your abilities. And, you know, at least in Dragon Age 2, the protagonist, if you're a mage, then your brother can become a Templar. He can become a Warden, but your father is also a renegade mage. So, you know, you've got this history of, you know, you brought this conflict of, I can't reconcile this power that I really have no choice over because it's an ability that's innate. It's not like I learned how to be a mage. So it's that kind of, do I hide who I am, or do I let this church basically color me? And that's kind of the narrative you're given, because what happens at the end of 2 is that a mage character who's in your party, you can befriend him, even romance him, can blow up the church. He's a murderer. But he comes down to this point of basically I've tried everything. I've tried to be reasonable. I've gone to these powers of authority, but they still don't see me even as human. This is my only way out, to kind of force change. So the question is, in something like that, you know, and this is kind of sort of badly attempting to circle back to faith in games, because a lot of people don't think about that narrative as they're playing the game, at least unless they're a lore nerd like me. Would this be another example of how a theme of faith throughout 3 games now, and kind of wrapping up with Inquisition, is that a way that, you know, we can have a theme but also do it badly? I guess is the very long question.
Okay, I mean, it sounds like in what you're describing, ultimately, that the church authority is the enemy. Is that correct? They're the bad guys.
Right.
It depends.
You can.
Yeah, but if your character is a mage, then they are. There's no question about it.
Okay. Well, so I mean, what it sounds like you're describing is something that often, I think, shows up in our culture, in our pop culture. We're a very individualistic culture, and we have a tendency to celebrate the individual over groups, over the collective, so to speak, right? And so, you know, you often see stories where there is a conflict between the individual who must be, you know, themselves and true to themselves, and then the community, often a religious community that's holding them back or telling them, you can't be that, or you can't fit there. That is a trope that is very deep in our culture. And in that, you know, because we are very individualistic, you know, ideally church is a community. It is the body of Christ, is the imagery that Paul uses. It's about more than just individuals. Now, church in America often is about individuals as well. We have a very individualized faith. But what you're describing to me sounds like that kind of sort of story trope conflict between individual and community, and ultimately individual is the hero.
Yeah. Now, if your character isn't a mage, then you have a sibling who is. So then it's a choice between the Chantry or your, like, family.
Okay. Yeah, it's the same kind of dynamic then, too, you know.
It's a lot easier to pick the Chantry, though, than it would be if you were the problem they have.
Sure. I understand, yeah.
And there's also your sibling and your whole family can die out over the course of the game, which is pretty terrible. But then it's like, is your character left with a grudge against the Chantry? Like, you know, and this is me just having a moment of Dragon Age nerdery, because you're a pastor, and I can ask you this religion question. Let's say if you had a character, Hawk is the protagonist, and they had this conflict, either they were a mage or not a mage, but they had to kind of make that choice. How would you pastor them?
Bah!
I stumped you. Ha!
You stumped me. Well, I mean, so, I mean, the way it sounds is it's a question of what do you choose? Do you choose yourself and who you are, or do you choose your community, mm-hmm. right? The community you come from. I mean, lots of people find themselves in those kinds of situations where they have to make a choice between who they are and what they feel they're being called to, and then the community, which might be telling their family or their church or their town or whatever, that's telling them, no, you are this, or you need to belong over here. It's a very common conflict. Mostly in a situation like that, I would ask questions, you know? It's not my place to tell people ultimately what choice they should make, but it is my job to ask questions to get them to sort of process and think about it. So I would ask them questions about, you know, what does this mean to you, and what is the consequence here, and are you able to live with the consequences of that choice?
Okay. It's just I had that moment and I decided to run with it because I was like, huh.
No, well, it's fine. It's okay. Pastoral care for video game characters.
That could be a segment of Geek Cross.
It could be. It could be. We could do, I don't know, pastoral care for Super Mario Brothers.
That would be awesome. Yeah, you have to do that now. Awesome. That would be amazing. Oh,
I'm not sure where fighting turtles falls in a religious setting.
I don't either.
We could figure it out. It's like there has to be some guilt about killing those turtles.
Well, maybe taking mushrooms leads, you know, he becomes bigger when he takes the mushrooms. He's having some sort of religious, you know, experience where he's larger than he is when he's not on the mushrooms.
The shrooms.
That's maybe the shrooms. Okay, now we're talking about drugs.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of religious traditions involving drugs. I mean,
very much so. Very much so. Yeah.
Now it could be Mario's unverified personal gnosis when he takes the mushrooms. Okay, before we get totally derailed, because now I'm just thinking of like all these random questions that have.
We're tired, aren't we? This is a result of podcasting.
A little bit, but also
right?
Just kind of like now I've come up with all these like scenarios of like pastoral care for video game characters. Who would be at the confessional first? But before we get too derailed, we do have a very good questions from our friend Tim.
Yeah.
So we've talked about this a little bit, but Tim's first question, and I'll give you the follow-up, and then David, if you want to ask the last one, is have you ever had trouble reconciling your faith with your entertainment, be that books, games, films, whatever? And then the follow-up to that is, are there pieces or have there been pieces of media that have challenged your faith and helped you grow?
I mean, yes, there certainly have been some times. I mean, for the most part, I'm not easily offended. I take most things in stride. But there are certainly times when there are pieces of entertainment that really make me uncomfortable, that really challenge me. I think that, for example, I think one of them would be violence. Not particularly violence per se. I really like Quentin Tarantino, but the glorification of violence. So, for example, I have a hard time with Red Dawn. Not the most recent one, but the 1980s Reagan-era paranoid fantasy and the way that violence is glorified in that. Like, that would be hard for me. Or Boondock Saints. I had a hard time with that one as well. I think sometimes the depiction, again, like I said earlier, of religious people is really problematic in a lot of entertainment. And especially the Amish, Mennonites are closely related to the Amish. Mm-hmm. I have Amish relatives, and often the depiction of the Amish in media is completely false and has very little bearing in reality. One of the things that's lately been kind of I find pretty offensive actually has been the reality TV programs on the Amish, like, you know, Breaking Amish or Amish Mafia. Those things have very little resemblance to what actually goes on in these communities, and I think are exploitive. And I have a hard time with Amish romance novels too. I think some of that is pretty exploitive. So things like that, I have a hard time with. There's actually a term for that. It's called Amish ploitation. So you know, because the Amish live a very distinctive life that is different from the surrounding culture, there's a tendency to romanticize them. Or also to treat him like a freak show. I have a hard time with that.
Okay.
In regards to entertainment that has challenged me and caused me to grow, that's a harder question. That's a very good question. I think there are times, maybe not challenge is the right word, but maybe like resonated mm-hmm. with in a way that made me help me make connections. I think, you know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer was a really important show when I was growing up. Well, not growing up, I was already in college, and it was still on when I first got married. And I actually interviewed my wife on one of my podcasts. We talked about the role that Buffy played for her, having left the Mormon church, and the idea of a female warrior, and the idea of sacrifice and community, and sort of found family. That was really important for her. And because I was married to her, we were going through that kind of together. So that show, I think, really did sort of shape me. It really resonated with that.
Okay. That's really cool.
Yeah. I think, you know, at its best, you know, these TV shows, this entertainment, you know, it gives us the stories of that we need in order to grow up and in order to know what it means to be an adult and to struggle with life and to have empathy for others and compassion. I think at its best, that's what geek stuff can do. You know, I think when it's just meaningless and it's just action-oriented stuff, even action-oriented stuff can have meaning to it. But, you know, I can't remember what it was. There was some video game that had a cartoon that was based off of it that was on Netflix one time. Oh, what is it called? I can't remember right now. It's about some sort of space station that is abandoned and people are turning into mutant monster kind of stuff.
That would be Dead Space.
Dead Space, yes. They did a prequel movie about that. And I watched it. And I actually ended up kind of felt sick of my stomach after all because I felt there was nothing redeeming about it at all. You know, but most entertainment has something about it that is that you can draw further meaning from it.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say it all does, and that there's no such thing as a non-interaction.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, how much you control the message you send.
Sure, sure. I think in most cases, yes. I think in most cases, there even with stuff that's not necessarily considered to be high art or good, there's something there that you can draw meaning from. But there have been a few times where maybe as a viewer, I had a certain reaction to it and I wasn't able to draw anything more out of it. That certainly could happen.
I wouldn't say it's necessarily a good message.
That's right. Fair.
I also didn't like the Doom movie. Like, for example, that would be another one. But again, it's the issue of violence there for me. It's also Doom.
Yeah. All right. The third question we got is, you have open and interesting interfaith discussions on Geek Cross Show. Was interfaith curiosity encouraged growing up?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it was really encouraged. It was kind of inevitable considering where I grew up. I spent part of my life here in the States, part of my childhood in Chicago. But I also spent a good part of my childhood in Germany, or what have been at the time West Berlin, because the wall was still up. And so from a very young age, I was always dealing with people who were different from me. Some of my earliest memories are crossing the Berlin Wall to go visit church friends in East Berlin and going to church in East Berlin. And so I've always had sort of an experience with people who were different from me. And then when I lived in Chicago, it was in South Evanston, which at that point was primarily an African-American community. Also, white flight issues. There was a lot of drugs and gangs and things like that. And I was one of the few whites in my school. So I've always have experienced people who had different experiences and different understandings than I did and relating to people. So I wouldn't say that I know, for example, what it's like to be a racial or sexual minority in America, but I certainly know what it means to be the other and to not look like anybody else or believe like anybody else around you. And so that has, I think, because of that experience, I have always had a tendency to look for those kinds of conversations and to find ways of finding common ground with people who are different from me. And to learn about their experiences. And so I think Geek Cross has reflected that because of who I am.
Yeah, because there's been some fascinating conversations I've heard on there that, you know, I would have missed out on otherwise.
Well, our conversation, I have to say, was one of those, Tanya. I had never, when I started the show, expected that I was going to have a conversation about Norse paganism as a religion, as a belief. That was one of those I didn't expect that we would go there kind of experiences. But that was a really good conversation. I had a lot of good feedback from that. And, you know, I think, you know, if we spend more time listening to each other, these kind of conversations are always possible. It's just the fact that we don't seek them out. We seek out mostly people who are like us and who agree with us. And we're often too busy trying to prove how right we are that there isn't space for those conversations.
Very true. Very true. I mean, that
you know, a lot of it.
That was a great conversation, and you know, and it segued into a lot of things that I hadn't really talked about because I don't get a chance to talk about them on here. So,
yeah, well, it makes a good podcast. It makes it interesting. You know, I mean, why have a podcast if you're always going to talk about the same things? You know.
Yeah, that's why you're here. So we don't wind up just always talking about a lot of the same things because you know. On occasion, I get flack from people when I try to bring up religion as a diverse topic over at the iDiverse Games side of things. And it's interesting that people seem to forget religion as part of diversity.
Well, I think part of that is because for a long time in our culture, Christianity had a dominant place. You know, we are, I mean, I don't really agree that we were a Christian country, but we certainly were an Anglo-Protestant culture. And I think a lot of us, especially those of us who are concerned about social justice issues and concerned about diversity, tend to be reactive to religion, particularly conservative Christianity, because it was the dominant culture for a long time, and that's changing. And, you know, I one of my sort of goals with the podcast is not to say that Christianity should dominate the conversation. I think we have to be humble, and I think we have to spend time listening as well, but I think we should be part of the conversation as well. And we're not there yet. I think we're still, a lot of people are I think, reacting to it for legitimate reasons. You know, I'm not saying that, you know, but there are criticisms of faith that I think are fair and others that are not fair. And we're not at a moment yet where we've moved beyond sort of this reactionary relationship.
Most definitely. But I'm really glad you're here, and this has been a great conversation.
I've enjoyed myself too a lot. I've enjoyed meandering.
Meandering
with you.
Is good. So I think that works better than just kind of a here's a script, here are questions, and then not really, you know, getting a chance for things to go where they will.
Yeah, I mean, I sense it's been a little awkward for you guys because it's a new format, but it's fine. It's okay. You'll learn.
Additionally, I don't know about Tanya, but sometimes I could just be terrible talking to people. But this has been comfortable.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. And we'll have you on sometime, and we'll talk about Shadowrun.
All right. Although, have you played Fallout New Vegas?
I have not. I mean, I've read about them, and I'm often a. What's the word I'm looking for? Like a not a participant, but an onlooker. You know, like I was the kid that when other kids were playing video games, I was content just to watch. So I don't know what that's about, but you know, so I know a good bit about Las Vegas, Fallout Las Vegas, but I actually haven't played it.
One of the DLCs, Honest Hearts, is about two Mormons.
Uh-huh.
And the ways that the narrative lets you take, like, their faith and how to interpret it are varied, which causes a scenario where you can play a character who has your interactions with them create a character arc for you, where you start out by laughing at them when they explain what they believe, and then using it to persuade them at the end.
See, I think that the challenge is that a lot of people who are writing these stories are not actually religious people themselves. And just like with any kind of diversity, when you write from the outside, it's very different than writing from the inside. I would like to see more characters that might be religious, but it's not their defining feature. That's not all that they're about. But it certainly is an aspect to them. And that, you know, and it takes it seriously, like what they believe seriously, not just simply, you know, local color, which is often what it feels like.
Well, the options you get dealing with them, you can either treat it seriously or you can laugh about it and then eventually come to the conclusion of, and that's what these people believe. I'm just going to let that go.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Wow.
I see.
Huh. You know. I've never played, well, I shouldn't say never. I've played New Vegas. I've not finished it. And I definitely have not touched any of the DLC. So that's, I find that interesting that there's DLC with Mormons in it.
Yeah. Yeah. The Mormons were huge in Fallout before Fallout 3. They got mentioned in Fallout 2. Because in Fallout 2, you could deal with the NCR, and the Mormons were one of the groups that they would discuss as their neighboring nations.
Okay. I mean, it would make sense. I mean, the Mormons are America's first homegrown religion, you know?
Additionally, they're all in... There's large densities of them in small areas, so...
Yeah, exactly. And they're part of the West. They're part of the Western expansion, huh. Yeah.
I learned something I didn't know. Mormons and Fallout. See, this is what happens when you have cool guests. but since we're already kind of talking about games and whatnot, we usually end the show talking about what we're reading / playing. You know, and you all can just keep talking about Fallout because I'm learning a lot. Or not.
Or not.
Okay. No, I'm all right.
Well, Jeremy, since you're our guest, is there anything in particular you've been like reading or getting a chance to play recently, not so recently?
So, well, I mean, the last computer games that I've played was playing Cities Skylines, and I also played quite a bit of Guild Wars 2, which in a lot of ways is a lot of fun, but also ends up kind of being the same thing over and over. But I enjoy that. I've been actually more interested in board games and pen and paper games, but being in southeastern Colorado, it's not exactly the mecca of geekdom there. I often end up playing either by myself or with my 7-year-old. And we've been playing the Lord of the Rings card game, which is actually quite excellent and very difficult. Yeah, so I actually recommend that one. Actually, it's really a good system that they've set up there. Good rules. In terms of reading, other than stuff for work, theology stuff, I've been trying to hack through The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. Light reading like that. It's over 1,000 pages of Nazism. It's taking me a while, but that's what I've been working on.
So why the Third Reich?
Well, again, partly it's the German thing. I have an interest in just German stuff because of having grown up there. And every once in a while, I dip my toes in the reading about the Nazis or the Cold War or things like that.
Now, I was just curious because, I mean, I can't talk. I've got a copy of Mein Kampf here, so yes.
Well, that's not Mein Kampf.
Oh, I know.
It's a little different from Mein Kampf. It's William Shire's
book. So it's like I can't criticize anyone. I was just curious.
Yeah, sure. No, it's because of you know, I've been to some of the places that these things happened at, and because I've gotten interested.
Yeah. David, what else have you been playing and or reading?
I've been playing Star Wars Uprising on my phone. Right now, everyone's participating in a battle with the Empire, but nobody's actually like around. So I'm in like the top like 1,500 players because Fallout 4.
Thank you, Bethesda.
And I've been reading, or I started reading the other day, Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel. I'm not sure how to say his name. Kahneman?
Sure.
Kahneman? He's an economist. The book is about how people have two different systems of decision-making we use, but we only ever really talk about one of them.
Okay.
We always like things to make sense in that we want to be able to trace the logical thread of why someone or something did something, right? Which isn't something we can actually always do with ourselves, because we have a fast system of decision making, which is how firefighters know, you know, things that they seem to do on instinct. Anyone with a sufficient amount of practice can basically make these make the decisions subconsciously accurately, but most of us can't because it's a very specialized thing. And when arbitrary data, like skin color, gets fed into the fast system, that's where you end up with subconscious racism. Ooh. Things like that.
That sounds like a really interesting
book, right? Actually. When you're done, when we're done recording, you'll have to send me a link to it. It sounds really fascinating.
It's on Audible and Amazon.
Cool. I will have to go check that out once I'm done reading, like, the three books I have to write a review for.
One of those is not Mein Kampf, I'm guessing.
That's like one of those books. I think that's been covered. It's like one of those things where it's like, I've got a copy of it. It's in my house. Oh, well. yeah.
It's a good thing we don't have to review Mein Kampf, because there are publications out there that have blanket policies where it's like, try to say something good about it, too.
Ooh.
Oh, man. Well, you know, the book is actually not legal in Germany. I mean, certain libraries have it, but you actually have to get special permission to read it. Yeah.
The more you know, and knowing it's happening. And knowing is half the battle. I'm boring. I've still been playing Assassin's Creed Syndicate, which is amazing, but there are missions in there that make me want to pull my hair out, because they're the, you can't kill anyone, you can't fight anyone, and you have to do these three things, otherwise you will fail the mission. So the last time I played for Extra Life, I did the same mission probably six times.
So does the game have some of the same issues that Unity did, or have those been fixed?
It runs smoothly. I've had no graphics glitches. No one's face is missing. And they learned how to animate women, because Evie Fry. So, you know, you cannot be just a dude assassin.
That's good.
I would recommend it.
Okay. Even though you can't kill people.
No, you can kill people, but there was a mission where one of your associates was framed for a murder.
Yeah, I would say, in general, in the game, you have to kill people.
Yes. It is Assassin's Creed, after all. But this particular mission, your associate's been framed for murder, so you have to destroy evidence, but you have to not kill cops. Like, the bobbies in the game, because you're in London, where I'm at right now, they are ruthless. Like, they do one-hit kills with their nightsticks. There's some weird allegory there with police now, but that's a whole other show. We'll be here till midnight. And I've played a little Witcher 3. I need to finish that game sometime this year, hopefully. And I actually have been reading Tana Nareve Du, Ghost Summer Stories. And it's a collection of stories, but they all have a common thread. There's a lot of, you know, talking about family and loss and spirituality and ghosts. And the idea of, like, children in the book can still see in some of these stories, especially the one group that goes together, where children can still see ghosts and deal with supernatural things, but the adults lose that ability. And one of the really powerful stories in there is about a family who's, like, in the South in this town called Gracetown. And the two children, you know, the one boy keeps seeing ghosts, and he keeps seeing the ghosts of apparently these three kids that were killed. And it turns out they weren't killed by the racist across the way like everyone thinks. But then the racist across the way burned down their house. So it's like these spirits are trapped there. So it's really interesting. So Tana Nareve Du, I would definitely get this book.
All right. Sounds very good.
It is. And now that we have talked your ear off and meandered all over from pastoral care of video game characters back to reading all interesting books, some of which are banned in Germany, we should probably let you go. But before we do, let folks know where they can find you online.
So, well, first of all, is our Twitter account at Greek, our Twitter account at Geek, blah, blah, blah. Well, first of all, there is our Twitter account at Geek Cross Show. I haven't done much with it lately, but as I hope to get the show up going again, you'll start seeing some posts from there. My personal Twitter is at JW Yoder. I also have a much neglected blog where I put show notes and things like that up and any kind of other thoughts I might have at jeremyyoder.net.
Cool. Well, when this goes live in the near future, definitely feel free to post it there as well.
Of course, yeah.
David, where can people find you?
I am on Twitter as @RedConversation. I have a website, davidrreeves.com. It has a contact form if you need someone to look over something you've written. I'm also on Patreon, patreon.com/redconversation, where I talk about mostly like story structure and sometimes just what I'm doing and what I'm thinking about, like whatever it is I'm thinking about.
Okay. And before I give all my info, I just want to thank you again, Jeremy, for hanging out with us. This has been awesome.
Well, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Anytime. So once we kind of, you know, get ourselves together after the holidays, you'll have to come back because the whole Starbucks Red Cup thing is something I'd love to talk to you more about post-holiday season.
I'd be happy to talk to you about the war on Christmas and the serious, serious, serious problem that is in our country.
Yes, that'll be an interesting conversation. That's why I said after Christmas, because then we won't have people yelling at us. So for me, everyone can always find me at CypherTyr, that's CypherOftyr, and or at iNeedDiverse Games, which is iNeedDivGMS. And after much meandering and very pleasant conversation, we can call this episode done. Say goodnight.
Good night.
This freaking cap. Hold on.
You want to be on a podcast? Is that it?
I assume you're editing this, so you know.
Yeah.
So, sort of.